York. This is Democracy Now!
If Syria wants to fight for their land, that's up to Turkey and Syria, as it has been for hundreds of years. They've been fighting, and the Kurds have been fighting for hundreds of years. That whole mess, it's been going along for a long time. Syria may have some help with Russia, and that's fine. It's a lot of sand. They've got a lot of sand over there, so there's a lot of sand that they can play with.
As more than 300,000 civilians are displaced by fighting in northern Syria, President Trump defends his decision to withdraw U.S. support for the Kurds, paving the way for Turkey's assault. This comes as the House passes a bipartisan bill to rebuke the president. Today, Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are in Turkey seeking a ceasefire. We'll get the latest with Congressman Ro Khanna. And we'll also speak with him about the legacy of Baltimore Congressmember Elijah Cummings, chair of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. He died earlier today. But first to Chicago, where 25,000 teachers and thousands more aides, custodians, and security guards have gone on strike.
Their strategy is to take back everything that we've already won in previous contracts and offer it back to us. Not with what we have already, not what our students deserve or what we're demanding, but the same thing or less. That's the problem here.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In northern Syria, as many as 300,000 civilians have been forced to flee as Turkey's assault on Kurdish-controlled areas continues. Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo have arrived in Turkey, where they're expected to meet with President Erdogan today. They are said to be pushing for a ceasefire, which Erdogan has so far rejected. Turkey invaded northern Syria after President Trump spoke with Erdogan on the telephone October 6th, and then the U.S. abruptly withdrew a small number of U.S. troops from the region. On Thursday, the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly to condemn Trump's actions in Syria in what the New York Times described as, quote, the most significant bipartisan repudiation of Mr. Trump since he took office. Shortly after the vote, Trump met with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other congressional leaders and had what Pelosi called a meltdown.
I think that vote, the size of the vote, more than 2-1 of the Republicans voted to oppose what the president did, probably got to the president because he was shaken up by it. And that's why we couldn't continue in the meeting, because he was just not relating to the reality of it.
Go ahead.
We witnessed on the part of the president was a meltdown. Sad to say.
Trump later said Pelosi was the one who had the meltdown during the meeting. Trump also distributed a copy of a letter he sent to the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, on October 9th, the day of Turkey's invasion. In the letter, Trump wrote, quote, "Let's work out a deal. You don't want to be responsible for slaughtering thousands of people, and I don't want to be destroying the Turkish economy, and I will." Trump ended the letter writing, "Don't be a tough guy. Don't be a fool. I'll call you later." The BBC reports Erdogan received the letter and threw it in the trash. Since the U.S. withdrawal, the Kurds have aligned themselves with the Syrian government. A number of former ISIS fighters who are being held by Kurds have escaped. We'll have more on the Turkish offensive later in the broadcast. In Washington, D.C., one of the so-called Three Amigos is slated to testify to House committee lawmakers today as part of the ongoing impeachment inquiry. Gordon Sondland is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union. He's a wealthy hotel magnate and real estate developer from Oregon. He received his ambassadorship after donating $1 million to Trump's inauguration. His lack of diplomatic experience led one White House foreign policy advisor to complain Sondland was a national security risk. Sondland is expected to testify about now-released text messages between him and Bill Taylor, the top U.S. diplomat to Ukraine. In one of the messages, Taylor texted Sondland, "Are we now saying that security assistance and White House meeting are conditioned on investigations?" Sondland texted back, "Call me." perhaps not wanting to leave a paper trail. He was referring to Trump's call for the investigations of his rival Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Britain and the European Union say they've reached a new Brexit deal ahead of the October 31st deadline for Britain to leave the European Union. The deal will still need to be ratified by both British lawmakers and European leaders. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he plans to put his deal to a vote in the House of Commons Saturday. Some British political groups, such as the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, say they will not support the agreement. Meanwhile, many residents across the United Kingdom continue to oppose Brexit. This is Johnny Kelly in Northern Ireland.
We're all border residents. We all have great concerns about the impact of Brexit. We consider it to be undemocratic in the sense that the people of the north of Ireland didn't vote for Brexit in the first place. All of the analysis out there would demonstrate very, very clearly that any Brexit will have a detrimental effect on the people and the economy of this island.
In Spain, massive street protests are continuing in the Catalonia region after 9 Spanish separatist leaders were sentenced to prison Monday for their role in Catalonia's bid for independence in 2017. On Wednesday night, protesters set up barricades and faced off against police for hours during the region's third straight night of protests. The Trump administration's proposed opening up millions of acres of Alaska's Tongass National Forest to logging, a move environmental activists say threatens the largest intact temperate rainforest in North America. On Tuesday, Trump told federal officials to reverse longstanding protections against tree cutting in the area. Critics say logging would threaten not only the ecosystem, but also the forest's profitable salmon fishery and tourism industries. Up to 500,000 children could lose access to free school lunches under the Trump administration's proposed changes to the food stamp program. That's according to a newly released analysis by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Critics of Trump's proposal say the new analysis shows the plan is even worse than we had feared, unquote. In Chicago, 25,000 teachers are walking out of Chicago public schools today to demand better pay and benefits, smaller class sizes, and more nurses, counselors, social workers, and librarians. The historic strike has brought the country's third largest school system grinding to a halt, with classes canceled for more than 350,000 students as thousands of striking workers and their allies take to picket lines throughout the city. The teachers have long demanded more support staff in schools and are demanding the city put this pledge in writing. Recent polls ahead of today's strike show Chicago residents support the teachers after headlines will go to Chicago for more on the teacher strike. We'll speak with an official from the Chicago Teachers Union as well as from the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. In more labor news, tens of thousands of General Motors workers are celebrating after the United Auto Workers and the auto manufacturing giant GM reached a contract deal that could end the longest strike at GM in a half a century. The agreement would include wage increases, improvements to the health insurance plan, and a path to full-time work for temporary workers. The announcement came after President Trump called the UAW president on Wednesday night. The workers will remain on strike for at least a few more days as the union decides whether to formally approve the agreement. The New York City Council is slated to vote on an $8 billion plan to close Rikers Island by 2026 and build 4 new jails across New York City in what many are calling a national model for prison reform. For decades, human rights activists have protested the violence, abuse, and mismanagement inside Rikers Island and have called for its closure. Yet many activists now oppose the plan to replace Rikers with 4 new jails, arguing it would be better to invest the plan's billions of dollars into communities and criminal justice reforms aimed at reducing the number of people incarcerated, such as bail vouchers. The group No New Jails NYC is staging a protest at 10 o'clock today outside City Hall to demand City Council members reject the land use proposal that will clear the way for the new jail's construction. And Maryland Democratic Congressmember Elijah Cummings has died at the age of 68. The longtime African-American politician has for decades championed progressive causes and the rights of African-Americans and the poor. He's also been a fierce critic of President Trump, who's called Cummings' majority black district a rodent-infested mess. Cummings was born in 1951 as the son of a sharecropper. In elementary school, he was told he was too slow and that he spoke poorly. He rose to become one of the most powerful orators in the Maryland State House and the first black House Speaker pro tem, then the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Congressmember Cummings also served as the chair of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. In 2016, Democracy Now! Spoke to Congressmember Cummings from the floor of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. I asked him about the mothers of the movement, the mothers of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, and other African-Americans killed by police who had just taken the stage at the DNC.
Keep in mind, I have a nephew who sadly died 5 years ago, being robbed. And I went to visit his room the next day, and his brains were splattered on a wall. He was 20 years old, a student at Old Dominion University, and he's dead at 20. And so I could really relate to those women, because when a child dies like that, you mourn for what could have been. And so, you know, but I think the key for that, the reason why that was so important and powerful, is so that people understand, just trying to get people to pause and understand the pain, or try to understand it. Those women were very bold. What they did was they took their pain, turned it into a passion to do their purpose. Pain, passion, purpose. And so I admire them, because they have taken that pain and now they're trying to help other mothers not have to go through what they went through.
Have you ever been stopped by the police over
many
the
times,
years?
Many times. Many times. And keep in mind, as a younger man, I got stopped a lot more as a younger man. I never forget one time I was fortunate enough to get an Acura automobile, and I was being stopped almost every week. I was about 32.
I need the memo.
And I was being stopped every week.
That was Maryland Democratic Congressmember Elijah Cummings. He died early Thursday morning at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore at the age of 68. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. 25,000 teachers and thousands more aides, custodians, and security guards are walking out of Chicago public schools today to demand better pay and benefits, smaller class sizes, and more nurses, counselors, social workers, and librarians. The historic strike has brought the country's third largest school system to a standstill, with classes canceled for more than 350,000 students as striking workers and their allies take to picket lines throughout the city. The strike was confirmed Wednesday when the Chicago Teachers Union rejected a final offer by the city's new mayor, Lori Lightfoot, following months of labor negotiations. The city offered pay raises of 16% over a five-year period, while union representatives have been calling for a 15% increase over 3 years. The teachers have long demanded more support staff in schools and are demanding the city put this pledge in writing. On Wednesday, Chicago Teacher Union's Stacey David Gates and Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot sparred as Lightfoot defended the district's effort to negotiate with the union.
At every turn, we bent over backwards to meet the union's needs. Despite all this, the Chicago Teachers Union intends to forge ahead with a strike.
To say that you've bent over backwards and it's the same proposal, not even less than what's in there now, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Some 7,500 public school workers with the Service Employees International Union are also striking today after rejecting their own offer from the city. More than 2,000 Chicago Park District workers with SEIU Local 73, who are also expected to strike today, struck a tentative agreement with the city Wednesday. They'll join the picket lines before work and solidarity. The walkout marks the first Chicago public school strike in 7 years. In 2012, teachers went on strike strike under former Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Today's walkout is expected to be one of the first big tests for Lori Lightfoot, who took office as mayor in May. For more, we go to Chicago, where we're joined by two guests. Stacey Davis Gates is Executive Vice President of Chicago Teachers Union, and Science Mellis is Executive Vice President of SEIU Local 73. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Stacey Davis Gates, let's begin with you. Why are you going out on strike today?
Good morning. Thank you for having us. We're on strike today because we don't see another way to actually get a social worker, a nurse, and smaller class sizes into our school communities. We are in one of the richest cities and one of the richest countries in the entire world, and we have prioritized building playgrounds for the wealthy in Lincoln Park instead of putting the nurse and schools on the south and west side of the city. We are shifting priorities, hoping to transform the way in which we value the very people who do the work in the school communities and those who desperately need the services in the school communities.
Science Mellis, can you explain what exactly is happening today and who all is involved?
Good morning. Thank you for having us. This morning, the SEIU Local 73 members at the Chicago Public Schools are standing shoulder to shoulder with the teachers union in the fight for a fair contract. So there's actions happening all over the city. There's pickets happening at every school in Chicago, where workers are demanding a fair contract and that the mayor be the mayor of the people rather than the mayor of the corporate America.
I wanted to go to a clip of Mayor Lightfoot speaking at a news conference on Wednesday. We're going to see if we have that clip, and we'll here we have it.
We have tried to provide the best deal that's fiscally responsible, that's fair to teachers and fair to taxpayers. Without question, the deal that we put on the table is the best in the Chicago Teachers Union's history. It provides a 16% pay raise for all employees. Beyond compensation, we have offered more than 80 proposed changes to the contract on issues requested by the union, including sanctuary school protections, a commitment against privatization, supports for oversized classes, changes to how we serve our special education students, and so much more. Folks, I'm the daughter of a union steelworker. I'm a strong believer in the power of collective bargaining. And yes, when it comes down to it, the right to strike. But today, we are making concerted progress. It is clear that this is not one of those moments.
So that's Mayor Lori Lightfoot. Stacey Davis Gates, can you respond?
We have a city that spends $5 million on dog parks. $5 million on dog parks. And what we are asking for is hard caps on class sizes that reach 40. 40 kindergartners on the south side of Chicago stuffed into a room. 35 kindergartners stuffed into a classroom in another school on the south side of Chicago. We are living in a city that is experiencing unparalleled, consistent amounts of gun violence. And we need a school nurse in the neighborhoods especially that are experiencing the brunt of this trauma. Our demands have been our demands for the last 10 years. This is not about Mayor Lightfoot. This is about breaking down systems of white supremacy that ask for flexibility and demand that Black children in this city adjust, demand that Latinx children in this city wait in line. This is not the type of world-class city that it promotes itself as if children do not have the basic necessities that are due to them in their school communities. She has every opportunity, every chance, every power to provide Chicago students with what they deserve, not what she wants to parse out, not with what she gets left over when she gives wealthy developers billions of dollars on the north side of the city.
And Science Mellis, could you also respond to what the mayor said? In particular, she said that the city has made 80 proposed changes on the issues that were raised by the union. What were those changes, and what exactly is the union calling for?
So I'm not quite sure what she's referring to about the 80 proposals. Maybe that's referring to CTU. But in our negotiation, it's unfortunate that the mayor decided to get serious in bargaining after a threat of a strike. What we've asked her to do is be a mayor that can, you know, she can make choices. There are several choices that she can make. She can either fund our schools correctly, offer the support that our students need in the schools, clean schools, safe schools. Instead, the mayor had made choices to put $33 million in policing our schools rather than, training our security officers to be able to respond to issues that pop up. And these are security officers that actually know these students in and out. They relate to them. They see them every day. They care about them. They've been around for a long time. We're also, she's a mayor that chooses to continue to invest in, Aramark and Sodexo, which mismanages our custodial services in our schools, which actually our schools are dirtier than they've ever been. And so we're saying make a choice and be the mayor of the Chicago that, elected you in. We're telling her to be a mayor of our, for our students. We're asking her to be a mayor of the people where it's an easy choice, but she chooses to not be that. She chooses the wrong, she continues to make the wrong decisions. And it's unfortunate, we could have avoided this whole strike. She could have avoided and came to the table in fairness and actually negotiated for the things that we are asking for. We're not asking for $1 million, $1 billion, $1 trillion. Our members are not making that much money. We have bus aides who have slept in their cars because they cannot afford to live anywhere else because they have split shifts. And so they can't even work a second job in order to meet their needs. But most of our members are working second, third, fourth, fifth jobs. And so if you ever come to Chicago, you probably get into an Uber. It's probably an SEIU Local 73 member and quite possibly a CTU member. And so we're asking her to invest in our schools. We're asking her to invest in our students. We're asking her to invest in the community that elected her. We're asking her to invest in Chicago. So she does have a choice, and we're hoping that she, comes to her senses and makes the right decision when it comes to our babies, in Chicago Public Schools.
Science Malice, can you explain what happened in the last hours where one of the locals of SEIU has reached a tentative agreement with the city and one is going out on strike? And how does that work? What demands were met? What weren't?
So I can give you an overview since I was not directly involved in the Chicago Public Schools contract negotiation. But what I do understand is that they reached a deal that's one of the best deals that they've had. And we represent about 2,500 workers in Chicago Public Schools. But that's different from what our issues are in CPS. Our issues in CPS have been, the class sizes are an issue for us. Our short staffing is an issue for us. Special education, we represent the SECAS, which are special education classroom assistants. That are often pulled from the services that they need to offer to kids, and instead they're asked to clean, closets, to be custodial, custodians. They're asked to be a recess monitor rather than be with the students that they are, hired to protect and provide services to. So, these two things are not, our members at the Park District are in support of our members at CPS. They're in support of the CTU members. They are actually right now as we speak on the picket line in support and standing in solidarity with the Chicago Public School workers. So that's where we're at right now.
Stacey Davis Gates, the last strike was in 2012. That was under Rahm Emanuel, the mayor. This is under Lori Lightfoot. What do you see as the difference, or do you see a difference right now?
Look, there are obvious differences. We have a mayor who basically took every contract proposal we put forth and created her campaign platform. She gave very eloquent speeches about students being in school communities that are fully resourced with nurses and librarians and class sizes that are manageable. She said on the campaign trail that she was committed to doing these things. And so we've already won the argument. We agree. The problem is that she does not want to enshrine this in a contract, in a policy that is dependable, that people can look forward to, that will help to transform our school communities. Listen, if you've lived in Chicago and you've been on the south and west side of this city, you see promises broken in those areas of the city all of the time. What we are saying as workers in this city is that you cannot continue to break promises to the people who need the resources the most. You don't break promises to build skyscrapers downtown on the taxpayer dime. You don't break the promises to build a wealthy playground for wealthy people on the north side of town. But somehow, there is always a question of flexibility and an expectation of adaptability for the people who need the resources the most in the city. This strike is about drawing a line in the sand and saying that the students who attend the Chicago Public Schools deserve the resources they deserve and they deserve the resources and they deserve the written commitment of city leadership.
And Stacey Davis, can you talk about, before we conclude, your concerns about class size in Chicago public schools?
Class size. You know, class size is a big deal for us here in Chicago. And spaces in the city that have suffered from mass school closures, that have suffered from the mass eviction of black people in the city, you see class sizes, 40 students in third grade class size in schools. Over at Beasley Elementary School, we have 3 third grade classes with about 40 students in each of those classes. That is absolute insanity. We have to get to a place where we bring those class sizes down, offer the students, again, who need the most, the best chance at getting the most. You cannot do that with class sizes of 40. It is not. It's immoral to have a school district in one of the richest cities and one of the richest countries in the world that does not prioritize the students in the city and provides them with things that they need. Look, the state of Illinois provided the city of Chicago with $1 billion extra dollars to lower class sizes, to fund special education services, to provide our school district that is dealing with concentrated poverty with wraparound supports to meet the needs of the students here. That money has to meet the school communities. And right now, our members, the teachers, the paraprofessionals, the teachers' assistants, the school clerks, the counselors, the nurses, they are saying we do not have enough to meet the needs of our students.
Stacey Davis Gates, you are a mother of 3 in the Chicago Public Schools. What will they do today? And there was a profile of you in the Chicago Sun-Times, and it talked about your mother, your aunt, your grandmother, all Teamsters who worked at Memorial Hospital. You told the Sun-Times they showed you that unions were powerful, especially for black women who were disinclined to be bossed. Explain.
Explain. Look, we live in a country that doesn't often hear or see black women, their worth and their work in this country. And the 3 women who helped to raise me, they gave me a strong sense of self. They told me to use my voice for justice, to make sure that I was in solidarity with those who needed justice the most and those who could fight for justice as well. And so that influenced my decision, obviously, to be in the space that I am in now. But it also drives this fight for us as parents and as taxpayers here in Chicago. I sent my kindergartner, my third grader, and my fifth grader to the Chicago Public Schools because I know that they deserve to be in spaces with other kids. I know that they deserve to have a nurse, a librarian, and smaller class sizes. Look, I am not just about leading. I'm about being a part of the coalition of people that's needed to help transform this. My children will be on the picket line today and every day until their schools get exactly what they deserve.
Late last month, 2020 Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders spoke at a Chicago Teachers Union rally. This is part of what he said.
It is no great secret that kids can't learn and teachers can't teach if the class size is too high. Tonight I say to the city of Chicago, substantially increase the pay and benefits for teachers in Chicago. And for the support staff in Chicago. Tonight, I say to the city of Chicago, sign a contract that deals with the desperate shortage of school nurses, of social workers, of librarians, and of other critical staff that keep our schools going.
So that's Senator Sanders. Stacey Davis Gates, have other 2020 presidential hopefuls come out to speak with you? Senator Sanders will be holding another presidential rally on Saturday in Queensbridge, New York. He'll be joined by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib are supporting Bernie Sanders. But the significance of having the candidates out there with you.
Look, we've gotten the support of five of the 2020 hopefuls. Look, the argument, it's not if our students deserve it. It is rather the fight is about making sure that these things are enshrined in a contract that is enforceable, that guarantees smaller class sizes. Let's be very clear. The state of Illinois has given the city of Chicago, its public schools, $1 billion more to do all of the things that Senator Sanders outlined at the rally here in Chicago. It is past time that the generational injustices and inequities that Chicago public schools has heaped on thousands of students, that they stop. We have a mayor who says that she agrees. We expect for that agreement to be enshrined in an enforceable contract where we can depend on smaller class sizes, where we don't have to wait for a nurse to get there, where we have a social worker who can actually provide our students with the trauma supports that they need. We have put contracts in writing that maintain filthy schools. We have put contracts in writing that over-militarize and over-police our school communities. Absolutely, you can put something in writing that provides smaller class sizes and wraparound supports.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Stacey Davis Gates, Executive Vice President of Chicago Teacher Union. Science Melas, Executive Vice President of SEIU Local 73. Of course, we'll follow the strike. And the latest news out of Detroit is that UAW and GM have reached an agreement, though it has not been fully voted on by the union. And this little correction, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar are endorsing Bernie Sanders. Rashida Tlaib has not yet done so. When we come back, as more than 300,000 civilians are displaced by Turkey's invasion of northern Syria, President Trump defends his decision to withdraw U.S. support for the Kurds, paving the way for Turkey's assault. Stay with us.
Bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way.
By Dolly Parton. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
As many as 300,000 civilians have been displaced as Turkey's assault on Kurdish-controlled areas continues in northern Syria. Turkey invaded the region on October 9th, shortly after President Trump virtually greenlit the assault by abruptly withdrawing a small number of U.S. troops who were protecting Kurdish areas in northern Syria. Since then, the Kurds have aligned themselves with the Russian-backed Syrian government, and a number of former ISIS fighters who were being held by the Kurds have escaped. On Thursday, the House of Representatives voted to condemn Trump's actions in Syria. The measure passed 354-60. The New York Times described the vote as, quote, the most significant bipartisan repudiation of Mr. Trump since he took office.
Shortly after the vote, President Trump met with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other congressional leaders. The meeting didn't go well. Both Pelosi and Trump later accused each other of having meltdowns. During the meeting, Trump also distributed a copy of a letter that he sent to Turkish President Erdogan on October 9th, the day of Turkey's invasion. In the letter, Trump wrote, "Let's work out a deal. You don't want to be responsible for slaughtering thousands of people, and I don't want to be destroying the Turkish economy, and I will." Trump ended the letter writing, "Don't be a tough guy. Don't be a fool. I'll call you later." The BBC is reporting Erdogan received the letter and threw it in the trash. Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo are now in Ankara, Turkey, where they're expected to meet with President Erdogan today. They're said to be pushing for a ceasefire. During a press conference at the White House Wednesday, standing next to the Italian prime minister, President Trump defended his recent actions, saying the U.S. should not be involved in the fighting in Syria.
They've been warring for many years. It's unnatural for us, but it's sort of natural for them. They fight, and they fight long, and they fight hard. And they've been fighting Syria for a long time. And on the border, that's the border with Syria. And I say, why are we protecting Syria's land? Assad's not a friend of ours. Why are we protecting their land? And Syria also has a relationship with the Kurds, who, by the way, are no angels, okay? Who is an angel? There aren't too many around. But Syria has a relationship with the Kurds, so they'll come in for their border and they'll fight. They may bring partners in. They could bring Russia in. And I say, welcome to it. Russia went into Afghanistan when it was the Soviet Union, and it became Russia, became a much smaller country because of Afghanistan. You can overextend. You can do a lot of things. But frankly, if Russia is going to help in protecting the Kurds, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. But it would be led by Syria. And Syria doesn't want Turkey to take its land. I can understand that. But what does that have to do with the United States of America if they're fighting over Syria's land? Are we supposed to fight a NATO member in order that Syria, who is not our friend, keeps their land? I don't think so. But Syria does have a relationship with the Kurds. The thing that's common is that everybody hates ISIS. Now, the PKK, which is a part of the Kurds, as you know, is probably worse at terror and more of a terrorist threat in many ways than ISIS. So it's a very semi-complicated, not too complicated if you're smart, but it's a semi-complicated problem. And I think it's a problem that we have very nicely under control.
We're joined by two guests in Washington, D.C. Ro Khanna is with us, Democratic Congress member from California, member of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform. Here in New York, Özlem Gönör is assistant professor of sociology and anthropology at the City of New York. She's a member of the Emergency Committee of Rojava. She is from Turkey and of Kurdish origin. When you hear President Trump, Professor, talk about the Kurds are used to fighting, we're not, that it's been a success because he said no U.S. soldiers have died in the area. What in understanding do you have as the images of funerals are coming out now of the hundreds of thousands of people displaced as the number who have died and of the connection to President Trump abruptly announcing he's pulling the troops, however small number, from northern Syria and the invasion happening directly afterwards?
So, I mean, he's saying that there are no U.S. soldiers that have died. That's because they put the Kurds in the front lines. And that is because the Kurds died 11,000, more than 11,000 Kurds of YPG and YPJ fighters died in fighting ISIS. And so the role of the U.S. troops there were they were a buffer zone. They were protecting. They were preventing a Turkish assault. They were preventing Turkey from invading, from occupying these territories, which the Turkey has intended to do since 2011.
How did just 28—I think Trump said 28 U.S. soldiers
yes.
were there. How could 28 soldiers prevent that?
I think
that?
He means troops. That's what I understand. Obviously, he has—all of this tells us that he has very little understanding of the region. He's talking about Iraq all of a sudden, which, you know, is—
Confusing Iraq with Syria.
He seems quite confusing, and he's quite confused. And I also have a feeling that he's getting these discourses and these messages from the Turkish president. For example, when he talks about the Kurdish fighters, when he names them as bad or not angels. So he's definitely getting discourses from the Turkish president as to how to define this. And he's also very obviously, you know, these people have always been fighting, these Orientalist depictions of the region, which is not true at all, and which, as we know, this wars in the region started with colonialism after World War I, and then the U.S. involvement in the region after World War II, in order to fight communism and leftist groups in the region. They have mobilized these jihadis, Islamist forces, since World War II, and then it had gained a new pace with the September 11 and with U.S. war on terror. So the U.S., if these people are fighting, and if the Kurds are fighting, it's because of the U.S. and Western powers' colonial and imperial policies in this part of the Middle East in general, and especially in this part of the Middle East, where Kurds are divided into four nation states who have repressed them, oppressed them, massacred them, killed them in thousands, and displaced them in millions. This is very, you know, this is also something that's not discussed, how Kurds in Turkey in the 90s were displaced in millions while the U.S. and Western powers were watching. So if there is war, if there is violence, this is not initiated by the Kurds. This is not even initiated by these nation states. This is because this nation, this complete area, I mean, Syria has been a proxy war. And this needs to be stopped. And he's taking no responsibility whatsoever for actions for a terrorist organization that grew because of the U.S. policies in the region. And so, I mean, it's just, he's very confused, giving multiple messages, but at the same time, this ahistorical, completely ahistorical depiction of the region. They have been all, where is he getting these facts?
Well, since the Turkish assault now, know, humanitarian aid organizations have pulled out. There have been reports of widespread casualties. What are you hearing about the situation on the ground now?
So the situation on the ground is very dire. There are the Turkish army aligned with the Syrian jihadi forces, and now the freed ISIS have been basically in Serekani, especially. There's been the fight has been very intense, and they are targeting. And this is where the war crimes and the humanitarian crisis start. I mean, this is not where it starts, but there's a big portion of it is that they are attacking hospitals. You know, the doctors Doctors Without Borders decided to get out of the... It's not safe for journalists. It's not safe for doctors. They're attacking hospitals. They're attacking infrastructure in many, many parts of northern Syria and many parts of Rojava. There's no water and electricity because they are openly targeting infrastructure so that people are displaced. And he did say that at the UN conference, September 24, it hasn't been that long. He said what he's intending. He said his major intention is to reconstruct this area, ethnic cleansing and displacing Kurds from this area, so that, in his words, that he could put his Syrian sisters and brothers, who have been, again, exploited, and they are facing extreme racism and exploitation in Turkey, within Turkey. So he's trying to draw this benevolent image of himself to attack and displace and commit acts of ethnic cleansing in the region. And there is also, it's very important, right after his UN speech, he gave this message to the Turkish investors to actually go in the region and invest in the region. So this is from the perspective of Turkish capitalism, which is in crisis right now. This is also an opportunity to go and invest and ethnically cleanse a region and reconstruct it, engineering. This is a war crime because they're doing population engineering. They're doing, you know, a complete project that he declared on the UN, that the world leaders watched, that the Trump gave a green light. He keeps saying he's not given a green light. But he did this after phone call, and he decided to take the troops out, which everybody knew that Turkey from 2011 on wanted to invade this region. In 2014, when Kobani was under attack, Turkey, there are proofs, several proofs that Turkey was supporting the ISIS fighters in their fight against the Kurds.
Well, I mean, President Trump knew this because in the announcement of his conversation with Erdogan on October 6th, the phone conversation where President Trump announced he was abruptly pulling back the U.S. soldiers, they said that Turkey would invade. We're going to go to break, and when we come back, we'll also be joined by Congressmember Ro Khanna. Stay with us. Music by El Gabasi. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As the House of Representatives has just voted to condemn Trump's actions in Syria, the measure passed 354-60. The New York Times describing the vote as, quote, the most significant bipartisan repudiation of Mr. Trump since he took office. We are also joined in Washington, D.C. by Ro Khanna, Democratic congressmember from California, member of the House Oversight Committee, which Congressmember Cummings headed. And in a moment, we're going to talk about Congressmember Cummings with Congressmember Ro Khanna. Our condolences to you on the death of your chairman, such a significant figure in U.S. history. But we wanted to go to this unprecedented, at this moment, bipartisan rejection of what Trump has done. Your response to what's happening now in northern Syria.
Amy, first, let me just say it's a sad day with Chairman Cummings' passing. He was a great man, a son of a sharecropper who was a civil rights icon in this country. And it's a real loss, not just for Congress, but for the country. President Trump has put American security at risk and has really been irresponsible. And this is a clear illustration of the difference between progressives who have been calling for military restraint and President Trump's America First policy that doesn't consider the moral worth of anything other than American interests. I would make two points. First, the compromise of national security. He pulled out our troops from the region without notifying the Kurds, without notifying any of our allies. And as a result, a lot of ISIS prisoners have been released. And these folks could be threats now to our interests and to the United States. So we were winning the war against ISIS. President Trump, with this one action, without giving any notification, has put the national security of this country at risk. More broadly, we have a moral responsibility in Syria. We called for regime change in 2011. We have helped arm some of the opposition groups to Assad. We have struck Assad when he engaged in the chemical attacks against his own people. We have had troops there fighting ISIS. We can't just get involved in a place and then walk away and not have some moral responsibility. We have a moral responsibility not just to the Kurds who fought with us against ISIS. We have a moral responsibility to accept Syrian refugees. We have a moral responsibility to help rebuild a society that was ravaged by civil war where we were involved. So these are the places where President Trump has shown absolutely no consideration for the obligations America has.
Well, I'd like to go back to President Trump's press conference on Wednesday afternoon. He talked about the U.S. military presence abroad and his decision to send additional troops to Saudi Arabia, even as he's withdrawing troops from Syria.
We're in many countries, many, many countries. I'm embarrassed to tell you how many. I know the exact number, but I'm embarrassed to say it because it's so foolish. We're in countries, we're protecting countries that don't even like us. They take advantage of us. They don't pay nothing. You probably saw, some of you wrote and covered the fact that we're sending some additional troops to Saudi Arabia. That's true. And I appreciate the fact that I negotiated for a short period of time, a matter of minutes, with Saudi Arabia, and they've agreed to pay for the full cost of all of that deployment and more, much more.
Trump was later asked about what's transpired since the withdrawal of U.S. troops from northern Syria.
Mr. President, you said you withdrew 28 troops.
28. They say it was 28. We thought it was 50, but it was about 28. 26 to 28 troops.
And
all accounted for. Nobody injured. Listen, all accounted for. Nobody injured. Nobody missing. It's really nice.
But look what's happened since those troops were withdrawn and since you had that conversation with President Erdogan.
You know what's happened? No American soldiers have been killed. That's what's happened.
So, Representative Khanna, can you respond to that? I mean, you yourself have taken a position asking for the withdrawal, saying that, you know, U.S. military should not be in the Middle East. What do you think President Trump, the Trump administration, could have done to safeguard the lives of the Kurds who are now suffering from this Turkish assault? And what kind of pressure could the Trump administration have put on Turkey to ensure the safety of the Kurds?
Well, I have called for responsible withdrawal, but not a withdrawal that is oblivious to human life in Syria or to American interests in Syria. President Trump, at the very first instance, should have notified the Kurds about what our intentions were and notified our allies. I mean, he did this in a phone call with Erdogan without even giving the Kurds notice. And in fact, we were misleading the Kurds to believe that the Americans would have their back. Second, we have a tremendous amount of leverage with Turkey. We could have gotten a deal with Erdogan that would have prevented this kind of invasion. We give them military support. We give them economic support. They are a NATO ally. There was no consideration of that with the Trump administration. But his answer really illustrates what he's thinking, in that he does not have any concern for non-American life. Here, it's just a total indifference to the fate of the Kurds who fought with us. That's not the American tradition. In America, we believe and have a consideration for human rights. And also, I think the president has totally miscalculated in allowing for the resurgence of ISIS, and his actions have led to this precipitous withdrawal. What I think is really going on here is that the president has surrounded himself with war hawks like Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo, and Bolton. They don't agree with his instinct of withdrawal. Even Mattis didn't. And so he feels constrained, and he's fighting his own administration, and that leads to rash actions that are destabilizing and hurt human life. It would have been much better if he had found people who had expertise and shared his value of withdrawal and would have been able to do so in a way that would have protected American interests and civilian life.
Well, Congressman Khanna, there seems to be some confusion about exactly how many troops the U.S. intends to withdraw from northern Syria and all of Syria. Trump says 28. What do we know about exact figures and where these troops are going?
Well, I don't have the details of the exact figures, but what I do know is the withdrawal has already given a green light to Turkey to invade, that there are already stories of the loss of human life. There is the story of thousands and thousands of people being displaced. So whatever action we have already taken has given Turkey the license to go in and begin the displacement of the Kurds. But I will be with our Armed Services and Oversight Committee getting the facts of what the president's policy now is. Is it a complete withdrawal? Does he intend to leave any troops now still there?
And what does it mean that the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, has also condemned this? I mean, the reason there's no action on most any issue between the House and the Senate is because the House is Democrat, the Senate is Republican, and so the Senate doesn't endorse what the House does. Is he going to put a similar measure on the floor? Is there going to be a joint condemnation?
I hope he does. I expect the Senate will do something. But we need more than just the condemnation of the president's actions. We need to have a framework in Congress for dealing with Turkey and making it clear that Turkey's economic relationship with the United States, their relationship on our military arms sales, are in jeopardy if they don't immediately stop the invasion, if they don't stop the displacement of Kurds. And then we need a plan in the Congress about our moral responsibility to take in Syrian refugees, to take in refugees who are Kurds, who have been displaced, to figure out what economic assistance we can provide to that area to help rebuild societies that have been devastated in a civil war where we have been involved.
And Congressman Khanna, what about the kinds of sanctions that the Trump administration has put in place? Are those sufficient? And has there been any discussion of military sanctions? The EU has, of course, imposed a partial arms embargo on Turkey.
We have been talking about potential arms sales restrictions to Turkey. It's something that the Foreign Affairs Committee is discussing and the Armed Services Committee is discussing. I don't think the sanctions have been sufficient for the simple reason that the Turkish invasion continues and the displacement continues. This will only be resolved when Turkey stops taking those actions. Unfortunately, as I realized when we did the Yemen War Powers Resolution, which also passed in a bipartisan way in the House and the Senate to restrict the president from refueling Saudi planes, what I realized then is that the president of the United States has an extraordinary amount of power. There's only so much that Congress can do. But I think we have to maximize our congressional oversight, which is really about restricting arms sales and economic aid to Turkey.
And if you can respond to the reports that we're hearing, as President Trump talks about the situation being nice there in northern Syria because no U.S. troops have died, the reports coming out of Syria, a Turkish airstrike on a civilian caravan in northern Syria Sunday, killing 15 people, including two Syrian Kurdish journalists, Mohammed Hussein Rasho, a reporter for Sira TV, journalist Saad Ahmed of Harar News. President Trump saying, if no U.S. life is lost.
Well, I think some journalist needs to just ask the president bluntly, do you believe it matters if non-Americans die? Is that a moral consideration for you? Do you care about lives that are non-American? And let him come out and say what America First foreign policy actually is. Is he saying that nothing has moral worth if it's not about American interests and American lives? That has never been the American tradition. We had a Declaration of Independence that talked about the rights, inalienable rights of every human being, the dignity of every human being. President Trump is perverting the very essence of American ideals when he makes statements like that. And moreover, this is not just about the loss of Kurdish life. This is not just the loss of journalists' overseas lives. This is about the resurgence of ISIS that our troops fought so hard over the last few years. And those ISIS fighters pose a threat not just to Syria or Turkey or the Middle East. They pose a threat to the United States.
Özlem, your response.
Your final.
Well, to add to that, first of all, Trump is trying to make it seem as if he's taking troops out of a war zone. I mean, there was no war before he withdrew the troops. So his withdrawing of the troops—
In that area.
It was a peaceful area. It was democratic, pluralist, feminist. They had their own system of governing. And the ethnicities that he claims that are fighting were living peacefully. They have developed communes that talked and discussed. It was the promise, the hope for peace for the Middle East. But then his withdrawal of the troops caused that war. So he's making as if he's taking the U.S. troops out of a war zone. It wasn't. He triggered this war. He created this war. And so he has the responsibility to stop it, which could have been stopped by a no-fly zone. So even we're not asking for the troops remaining there forever. We have asked for guarantees such as no-fly zone that would prevent this war, which he didn't.
And, of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. Özlem Gonar, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at the City University of New York, and Congressmember Ro Khanna of California. Again, our condolences on the death of the Oversight Committee Chair, Elijah Cummings. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website is democracynow.org.